You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Every town has its story. Often it's an attachment to an historic event, achievement, or perhaps a famous resident which the community wears as a sort of badge of honor. In lesser fortunate communities, instead of being a source of pride, their story is viewed as an ugly scar its people long to have forgotten. I'm from one of those unfortunate places, and during this series, I'll tell you one of the stories of my town, perhaps its darkest. Sydney, Nova Scotia is barely a city. With just 30,000 residents spread over a good amount of space, it's hardly the type of place where violent crimes occur. The occasional burglary or stolen car, sure, but here murder is big news, and rarely is it a random crime. Tonight's story is exactly the kind of thing we thought could never happen. The innocence we had been enjoying would face its attack on May 7th of 1992 when 18-year-old McDonald's employees Derek Wood and his two friends Freeman McNeil and Darren Muse would put into action a plan they had to rob the McDonald's Derek had been working at. After sneaking into the back door just after closing time, the trio would be responsible for a robbery gone wrong that would result in the most brutal mass murder my community's ever seen. In the end, there would be three dead, one permanently disabled, and an entire community stunned. Tonight's story will be the first in a series covering the 1992 Sydney River McDonald's murders. In the hours after this crime, the news traveled first through Sydney, then across Nova Scotia, and ultimately throughout the world. Everyone was tuned into the news, hoping to hear the details and motive behind the heinous crime occurring in a family restaurant we're all so familiar with. With all eyes and ears now directed at a small town's news team in well over their heads, a local reporter rose to the occasion. Masterfully, he carried the story from its first moments, through the arrests, the trials, through his best-selling book, and still to this day, 25 years later, he's telling the story. He described himself to me as a well-worn pencil, and I'm sure a lot of the wear and tear put on him was related to this case. For those of us who grew up in the wake of the McDonald's murders, it's hard to think about that time without hearing his voice providing narration in our minds. When I decided to share this story, I couldn't have imagined doing so without his collaboration. So, with my tail between my legs, I contacted the man who, here in Atlantic Canada, is journalism royalty. I fully expected him to laugh at me in my podcast, but Cape Bretoners aren't like that. Instead, he invited me to his home for an interview. What he did laugh at, however, was my offer to stop at Tim Hortons and pick him up a coffee on my way. And now, looking back, I know why. He makes really good coffee. I'll let him introduce himself now.
My name is Fons Jessam. At the time of these murders, I was a reporter with ATV in Sydney. I was the reporter who covered murder or crime. That was one of the beats I covered. So I got the call very early on the morning of the shootings about taxi drivers reporting a shooting at the McDonald's. So I raced there, met up with a cameraman, and started coverage that lasted 3 years through three trials and ended in me doing a half-hour documentary for the CTV network and ultimately writing the book Murder at McDonald's. The story that grew from that single phone call early in that May morning of 1992 became arguably the biggest story I've ever covered in my 35-year career.
Now that you've met Fons Jessam, we'll begin our march to this story that, to the people of Cape Breton, is seen as one of those events that serves as a sort of landmark in time. People remember where and when they first heard Fons Jessam report this news. Before we get into the event, let's take a moment to get familiar with the story's setting. When Fons and I sat down, I was amazed at how he was able to break down my city's history. I guess years of reporting its news will do that. Here's how we describe Sydney at the time of this crime, 1992.
Yeah, Sydney was a city in decline and had been really since 1967 when Hawker Siddeley announced they were closing the Sydney steel plant. By 1992, the steel plant was still functioning, but nobody expected it to last. Nobody in my generation, we graduated high school in 1980, went to work at the steel plant, and we were the first generation not to. You know, my father, grandfather, they all did. Either the coal mines or the steel plant. But that was in, both industries were in decline. because they were tied together, and coal was seen as a dirty fuel elsewhere in the globe, so exports were in decline. And by 1992, the economy was in full decline, but the people really didn't realize it. Sydney was a city in name only, and everybody believed they were going to do something to fix it and bring it back to its glory days. But it was a city that depended on a global economy that had changed, and it didn't change with that global economy, so it was doomed. And that sort of set the stage for what was happening in Sydney in 1992. There was sort of a disenfranchised youth at the time because there was nothing to look forward to in Cape Breton. There was an older generation that believed these politicians have to come back and finish what they promised, except those politicians were retired and the new ones didn't care. You know, and there were people like me. I was fortunate enough to get a job in my own town. Pretty much my whole graduating class had left Cape Breton. But it was still a place where there was a fierce pride, a sense of we help each other, we gather together. And that came in a large way out of what happened in 1967 when 20,000 people marched up Prince Street to the harness track and try and save the steel plant. Black Friday, it's called, will happen on Friday the 13th. Wow. And that sense that if we all pull together, we can save this thing still existed in that generation. So when somebody came on hard times or something bad happened, the community really did rally around. You know, if somebody had cancer, that meant going to Halifax for treatment, and people would have fundraisers immediately. They still do. That's still very much a part of the Cape Breton culture. Sydney had been immune for a while because it was the industrial core and it was the serious business of making steel and marketing, and it was a city. But by 1992, really, it wasn't a city. It was, as I say, a city in name only. And I think that started with that march in 1967.
Now with the stage set, we'll next be introduced to the young man who is seen as the ringleader of this crime, or at least as the gasoline that the match would eventually be thrown into. It's with 18-year-old Sydney River McDonald's employee Derek Wood that this story starts. Fonz will explain the type of person Derek was and where he was in life just prior to his involvement in the Sydney River McDonald's murders.
He was that guy in your high school class that was quiet, and you never really knew quite what he did when school was over because he wasn't in any of the groups or involved in any of the extracurricular activity. He was a little mousy, a little nervous, a little awkward, but wanted very much to fit in, but kind of disappeared. Nobody knew where he went after school, you know, because he probably went home. He managed to land a job at McDonald's in Sydney River, unfortunately, fortunately for him at the time. As far as his dreams of a future, he was not the kind of guy to look beyond now. He had no sense of a future. I suspect if he hadn't have fallen in with the group he fell in with and developed the fantasy that we're going to be good fellas, we're going to be the ultimate gangsters and bad guys, he probably would have gone on to become a manager at a McDonald's restaurant for his entire life. As you know, in the economy that still exists in Cape Breton, which is still suffering from that change, there are people who at that time started working at McDonald's or Tim Hortons or those industries that traditionally in a city employ young people during their university years, and then they move on. But people who started there in the late 80s, early 90s, still work there today. It's a career. It's a career choice to work in the service industry in Sydney. And I suspect that would have been his career, but his nightlife, he got mixed up with a crowd of people who felt that break-and-enters or stealing from cars was okay to help supplement your fun, because not all of them were able to get jobs. And Derek had done some petty crimes, some petty break-ins, and that sort of brought him to the attention of the more popular young men like Freeman McNeil and Darren Muse, because he was a willing participant in these petty crimes. So he was on two paths. He probably, had this not happened, would still be working at a restaurant in Sydney now and would have straightened up, like a lot of those other kids who were involved in those petty crimes did. Mm-hmm. But he did get mixed up in this, and his life changed dramatically.
As you will soon hear, it took more than just Derek Wood to set into action and carry out this brutal crime. Our next step is to hear Fonz describe Derek Wood's two accomplices, 23-year-old Freeman McNeil and 18-year-old Darren Muse. Aside from just who they are, it's important to understand the relationship between the three young men, as many believe it's this dynamic that would ultimately be the match that was cast into the gasoline I mentioned prior.
Freeman McNeil and Darren Muse were very popular in high school. They were confident, good-looking, outgoing. They were the kind of guys that drew attention to themselves. So they made sure that whatever grouping they were in, they were sort of in a leadership role. They were popular, but high school ended. They were going to be the kind of guys that Bruce Springsteen sings about in Glory Days. It was over. And they didn't have the hockey past, or even they had no real glory. They were just popular kids, but it was over. And they were hanging around pool halls, and Freeman was trying to get work as a security guard. In fact, he did. Darren wasn't really looking to do anything. He was talking about, he was a martial artist, and he was into fitness, and he wanted to teach kids, and he was talking about those things, but he talked about everything. So they were still sort of attractive to Derek because they were popular, and he wasn't. He was the silent high school kid, right? The one who sort of drifted in and out of class and did little else. So he attached himself to them as part of their criminal enterprise.
Now, at this point in our story, McDonald's employee Derek Wood and his two friends, Freeman McNeil and Darren Muse, are spending their time dabbling in introductory level criminal activity and leading lives with little in the way of purpose or direction. We'll next hear about the random, seemingly insignificant event that led Derek Wood to get the idea to rob the McDonald's restaurant he had been working at.
They had originally planned to rob those vans that fill the bank machine until they realized the guards wore guns, and then the appeal quickly faded. But Derek, he was still a new employee at the restaurant. He had just passed his employee test and was about to become full-time, and so that puts him in roughly the three-month category. But he did pass. He was going to be given his permanent job. But he didn't really know the business that well yet, because he was working kind of part-time and full-time and taking shifts where he could. And he was sent downstairs one day. The conveyor belt that came from the back that the supply trucks would unload, and that would take all of the supplies down to the basement where the big freezer was and where everything was kept. Obviously, it wasn't up in the main restaurant. All the storage was done in the basement. They couldn't get the conveyor working. So Derek was assigned to go help the guys unload the truck from the lower back door that he had never seen before. And he went out and he opened it up, and they were carrying things in. And he happened to look in the downstairs office, which he had never seen before, and he saw this great big safe. Big safe, big money. That's the mind of Derek Wood. He had himself convinced, and quickly convinced Freeman McNeil and Darren Muse, there would be $200,000 on a Wednesday night. He had no idea that restaurants did daily deposits. He saw the money leave the upstairs office safe and go down to the downstairs office safe, and he believed that's where it stayed. He didn't realize it was just part of a process of keeping the money moving out of the building downtown and into the bank. So that broken conveyor belt is as much as anything responsible for the plan that began to develop in his mind that he could share with his new friends about the big heist, the $200,000 score they were going to make by emptying these safes, the two safes, up and lower.
With the idea, perhaps fantasy, that the restaurant's safes would carry in excess of $200,000, Derek Wood, Freeman McNeil, and Darren Muse began the steps necessary to orchestrate this heist. As you'll hear Fonz Jessam explain, their planning, or lack thereof, would quickly put them in a position to make some deadly judgment calls.
It was nothing more than an idea. I mean, they did. Freeman McNeil went out and tested the gun, shooting at some ice floes in the harbor. They talked about it. They tried to involve some other kids, two in particular. They went a week or two earlier, possibly even a month earlier, to do it. And the fourth didn't show up, so they bailed that night. But their idea was that Derek would prop that door he had discovered open. And remember, we're back in 1992. That wasn't going to set any alarms off. It was just a door that could only be opened from the inside of the restaurant, so there was no real reason to have it alarmed. Mm-hmm. It wasn't. So he was going to prop that open. He was going to let his co-conspirators in. The plan was to have a man in the car, a man on the door, and two go in and clean out what he believed would be this huge hall, that he was going to convince the manager to open the safe. He had seen them. He started to watch them around the safe as much as he could, and he thought he knew most of the combination from watching. So that's the kind of planning he was involved in. But it was, you had one guy walking in with a full face mask and another guy walking in with a gun and no mask, and he was the only one who needed a mask because he worked there, and another guy walking in with a shovel handle. These guys didn't do a lot of planning. They just expected to walk in and be handed the money and walk out. There was no criminal mastermind in that group. There was no real planning. There was no planning at all beyond what was going to happen once they had the money. And there was no planning as to what should happen if they encountered employees. And that ultimately was the big flaw.
When one considers what eventually happened during this crime, a question commonly asked, and likely an impossible one to answer completely, is what was motivating the trio to turn their fantasy of robbing McDonald's into reality? When I spoke to Fonce Jessam, he tackled the question this way.
Darren Muse and Freeman McNeil liked to exaggerate their importance. They were still trying to sort of cling to that, the sense of being the it guys that they had developed in high school. But they weren't. And so they decided they were going to be big time criminals, nothing small. They were going to start a life of crime. And this was going to be the nest egg. They were going to, $200,000 in 1992 was a lot of money. $200,000 for these guys, they probably thought they could each buy a home. They weren't that bright. But there was no, okay, here's how much anybody is going to get planning. Freeman, prior to the robbery, put some stereo components on layaway at local stereo stores. He was into, installing stereo systems in both his own car, his girlfriend's mother's car, and some, I believe, his own mother's car. So he did put some things on layaway in anticipation of his big windfall. There's no evidence to suggest, and there never was, that Derek had any plans for the money. In fact, he never took any of the money that they did get. And nothing to suggest Darren Muse had any plans for the big haul they were about to make. They were just starting a career that they were fantasizing about. They were watching cheap movies and trying to live the gangster lifestyle.
Now, with our story's background adequately described, we'll get into the night that so many terrible decisions were made by this group. Fonce will start by explaining the scene in the McDonald's restaurant just prior to closing time as Derek Wood's shift ends. Also, we'll now be introduced to the victims of this senseless act.
Derek finished his shift as the restaurant closed, but didn't leave, which was unusual. He went out front into the main restaurant area with another of the workers who was waiting for a drive and sat at one of the tables and they smoked, which once the restaurant was closed, Donna Warren, who was the night manager, allowed them to do that. It was sort of against the rules, but it was closed. And she was a very nice person and she really did look after the workers that were on her shift. She was a young woman from North Sydney who had just graduated high school and was planning to go to law school. She was working at McDonald's to get tuition together. She wanted to be a lawyer. But she had taken that shift as a favor. She wasn't supposed to be there. Her friend, Arlene McNeil, was a counter worker, as was Derek and the other person he stayed smoking with. They were supposed to leave when the restaurant closed. There was no reason for them to be there at all. The only people supposed to be in the restaurant were Donna, whose job it was to tally up the money, close up the safe, and Neil Burrows, who was the maintenance man. The maintenance shift was divided in two. He wasn't supposed to be there either. He had injured himself in a car accident, but agreed to come back to work early if they gave him the early maintenance shift, which had none of the heavy lifting, just the cleaning. So he was already at work in the kitchen, cleaning up the counters, the grill, the stainless steel facing on all of this, the appliances back there. So he was doing that. Donna was doing her job of counting up the receipts and get everything ready to seal in the safe. She was also filling the trays that would be taken by the morning workers and inserted into their cash registers, the floats, because every cash register obviously has to start with a certain amount of cash in it. And she was responsible for getting the morning floats ready. The night manager did that. That's why she was staying. She and Arlene were close friends. They both lived in the north side, but they didn't depend upon each other because they both had cars. But they were nervous young women and decided they would rather drive two cars, one behind the other, in case one had car trouble, or just they kept each other company on the drive home at night, set from separate cars. So Arlene was waiting for Donna to finish up so she could follow her home as far as North Sydney, where Donna would have turned off. Arlene herself was going a little further to her home, which was out in the Bradour area. So she should have been gone. Derek should have been gone. And the other worker waited for a drive and did leave. And then when that worker left, the other counter worker, Derek noticed that Arlene was getting materials ready for a child's birthday party at the restaurant the next morning. Arlene wasn't one to just sit around and wait for her friend. She wanted to do what she could do to help the restaurant for the next morning. She was a very vivacious and energetic young woman and a very positive personality and a positive presence in the workforce. And so it wasn't her job. Her shift had ended. She had already clocked out, but she was getting the sticks for the balloons and the straws and everything ready so that the early morning worker would have a leg up when they get in, keeping herself busy until Donna finished. So Derek volunteered to help. Very unusual. Arlene didn't really know him. He was new. No, none of the employees knew him well. As I say, he had just passed his employee accreditation. He had just managed to make himself a part of the real workforce. But she thought that was very generous. That was nice. He helped. So he helped for a while. And then he disappeared. They just thought he went home, when in fact what he had done was he went down to the basement where he had been working with her, and he made his way out to that back door, opened it up, and waited, because his co-conspirators were supposed to arrive and meet him at the door. But at that time, they didn't. But that was the scene in the restaurant. What you had was a group of young people working, none of whom should have been there. But through a variety of circumstances, they all were there. They were all really good, dedicated employees, and they were just doing their jobs.
As you just heard, the scene inside the McDonald's restaurant was completely average. There was no way any of them could have ever imagined the terror that was about to be unleashed on them. Fons will now walk us through the attack step by step, starting with Derek Wood opening the basement door of the McDonald's restaurant, expecting Freeman McNeil and Darren Muse to be on the other side waiting to enter.
The plan originally was for Freeman McNeil and Darren Muse to drive Freeman's car across the Sydney bypass, and there was a side street with a bit of a dirt road that led nowhere, directly across from the restaurant. So that was sort of the parking place for the getaway vehicle. Run across the highway and meet Derek at the open door. Well, they weren't there. So he was trying to figure out where they went, and he went inside and called the payphone where they were supposed to be, and he wasn't getting an answer because they were sitting in the car. It was cold that night. So he ran down to the Tim Hortons across the street and found them and said, well, what's going on? You know, let's get this thing done. So once they got their initial lack of coordination out of the way, the three of them went around, parked the car, came back, and he had left when he ran across the street. That's why his kit bag was in the door. He was going to be holding the door open. His kit bag was not. But because he had to run across the street to try and find these guys, this was his backup. Because if that door closed, that was it. There was no outside handle. It was like the door on a crack house. That's how you can tell a crack house, if there's no outside door handle. So he propped the door open with his kit bag, ran across the street, got in the getaway car with his co-conspirators, drove to this dirt road across the highway. They ran across the highway down through the front of the restaurant, stepped over the bag inside, and they were making their way into the restaurant. Darren Muse had a full face mask on. Freeman McNeil was carrying a shovel, and for reasons nobody ever explained or understood, Derek had the gun. I believe to this day this crime would not have occurred had either of the other two had the gun. But Derek had the gun. Why he was surprised to see Arlene McNeil next to Donna Warren, I don't know, because he left the restaurant a short time before. I think he had expected that she would be gone. Initially, he thought he would get into the downstairs safe without anyone spotting him and get the combination. And if the big money was in there, then they could go. but really he didn't know the combination. And Donna came downstairs to help Arlene, who was finishing up for that children's party. So the two girls were downstairs getting ready to leave, get in their own cars and go. And they should have been gone. So they walked out of the office and were just talking and walking as these three guys came out of the dark. They were coming out of the storage room where that door was, where nobody should be. And the two groups stopped. It was just this awkward pause. And then Arlene McNeil recognized Derek. And then she thought it was a joke because masked man, guy with a stick, and Derek. Well, it's Derek. He just helped me. So she said, "Is this supposed to be funny?" And Derek shot her in the head. And she fell. And Donna began to scream, fell down beside her, tried to help her, and he grabbed her and told the other two guys, "Keep her here." And I think the other two at that point were as shocked as Donna, that his initial reaction was to shoot Arlene. He didn't need Arlene. He needed Donna. So he shot Arlene in the head. She was still breathing, still alive. And Donna stayed on her knees on the floor next to her trying to help her friend. And Freeman McNeil stood over her with the club. Darren Muse had a knife. So they kept her there and they listened as Wood ran upstairs and they heard gunfire. The statements of all three men, including Wood himself, vary on whether there was one shot or two when he went upstairs. But he went up to shoot Neil Burrows, who was the maintenance man who was doing the cleaning in the kitchen. And then he ran back down and he grabbed Donna and he said, "Come on." And the other two followed him upstairs. And he took Donna into the room with the safe that was upstairs and ordered her to open it. She was crying, of course, and begging for her freedom and struggling with that safe. In the meantime, the other two got caught up in what turned into a killing frenzy. I mean, I've talked to forensic psychiatrists about this, and they believe it's highly unlikely that three young men were severe sociopaths, although they appeared to be, and they think it was more likely that they got caught up in a mob mentality at that moment. And these guys couldn't kill Neil Burrows. He was in his late 20s, father of a very young boy, husband, and tough as nails. It's the worst crime scene I have ever seen, and I've seen many in this country and others. He fought. He kept climbing back up that stainless steel skirt to the stove, and his hand marks and blood stayed there to show. They shot him in the head twice. The first shot that Derek did deliver, and I believe he only shot him once. I believe one of the other two shot him as well. Went in beside his ear and exited his throat. It didn't penetrate his skull. And that's why he was alive when the other two went up and found him. Derek Muse cut his throat to try and kill him. Freeman McNeil pounded on him with the shovel handle. When he would be climbing up, he'd club him back down. And Darren kept trying to stab him with the knife after having cut his throat. And then one of the two, and it depends on whose version of events you believe, and the only person who was really honest in his statement was Wood, and he can't recall which of the two came for the gun, but he thinks it was Freeman. Freeman claims it was Darren. Darren says he didn't shoot anybody, he just cut his throat. But one of the two got that gun, and that's where that second shot, there's no evidence of that, but that second shot entered his brain. When Derek went up, he shot him twice, there wouldn't have been the fight. Either would have been no Neil to fight. So, you know, the evidence at the scene, the struggle, the blood, the fact that they cut his throat, clubbed him, shot him twice, stabbed him repeatedly, suggests that when Derek Wood went up and shot him that one shot that didn't penetrate the brain and ended up in his throat, and that the other two did everything they could to kill him without the gun, and then decided to get the gun to finish the job. By that time, Derek had given up on the downstairs safe, cleaned out the upstairs safe, although there were $5 bills and $2 bills on the floor. He shot Donna Warren in the head and again in the eye, at very close range. There was black stippling and it showed that it was maybe an inch or two from her eye. She was laying on her back after the shot in the back of the head to take the shot in the front of the head. And her blood spread very quickly and surrounded the bills that were spilled, so they were left. And he went to the other two who were still in this violent orgy with Neil Burrows just meters away and said, we got to go. And at this point, Jimmy Fagan arrived. He wasn't supposed to be there for another hour. His shift didn't start for an hour, but he liked to come early to meet with the late shift people who were still there and just clown around a bit. He was very much the Mr. Congeniality of the Sydney River McDonald's restaurant, if that's applicable. He was just a fun, loving guy who loved his job and loved the people he worked with and went to work an hour early just to talk to people. He didn't have to be there. And he had traded shifts with Neil Burrows. That's how Neil managed to get the light duty shift. So in essence, I guess if anybody should have been there at that time that night, it was Jimmy, but he had given up his shift to Neil so he could come back to work early because he had been injured in an accident and he needed the lighter duty. But Jimmy was an hour early. And when they opened the door, he was standing there. And he looked and he recognized Derek Wood as the new guy, but he wasn't sure what happened, what was going on. And Freeman McNeil shot him in the face. And then the three of them stepped over him and ran across that highway back to their getaway car to start their escape.
At this point in the story, the trio flee McDonald's, leaving in their wake three dead and one grasping for life in a pool of her own blood. As Fonz just described, as they made their escape from the restaurant, they were met by Jimmy Fagan, who was just entering, only to be shot in the face and killed by Freeman McNeil. As it would turn out, this part of the crime had been witnessed by the cab driver who had just dropped Jimmy off at the McDonald's restaurant. It's this cab driver who would make the initial report of the McDonald's murders to local police.
He had driven Jimmy Fagan to work before, and he knew that he'd be going in the door beside the drive-through, which was the employee entrance. So he circled his car around to allow Jimmy to get out and go in, and he saw that the door opened. So he knew his fare was good to go. So he was driving and had turned right, or left, pardon me, to drive down the long driveway of the restaurant when he heard the bang, pop. Wasn't quite sure what it was. And then he looked and saw two men running. He didn't see three. And he thought, what the heck is that? And the door didn't close. So he circled back up around and came back and looked. And he could see that Jimmy was laying half in the restaurant, half out of the restaurant, face down. And he realized the sound he had heard must have been a gunshot. So he was terrified. He started to leave. He radioed it into his dispatcher that his fare had been shot. He'd seen men running, that there was something wrong going on. Please call the police. He was told to stay there. Another cab driver radioed, had heard him. Stay there. We're on our way. And cabbies began to converge on the restaurant to help their fellow driver and to see what the heck was going on. One of those early arriving cab drivers jumped out of his cab and actually tried to deliver medical assistance to Jimmy Fagan, who was still breathing at the time while they waited for the ambulance. The taxi dispatcher called the police and ambulance, but the driver who had allowed Jimmy to get out to go to work never got out of his car until the other drivers arrived. He was simply terrified, and he continued to circle. He didn't stop his car. He was afraid to put it in park. He just circled that upper parking lot to make sure nobody could open a door and get in, or nobody could shoot him while he waited, you know, minutes only, but what probably for him seemed like hours for those other cabs to arrive, and then the police and the ambulance.
With both the local police department and the local taxi driver community on their way to the McDonald's restaurant, we will end part one of this series by hearing Fonz describe the first moment of the trio's getaway. Specifically, we'll hear about Derek Wood's realization that he left something at the scene of the crime that will unquestionably tie him to the McDonald's murders.
The car was parked across the street a distance away from the restaurant. So they ran across the highway, the 125, and got into the car. But before they get into the car, Freeman McNeil didn't want to have the shovel handle. He still had his shovel handle because he was afraid it had blood on it and he would get blood in the car. So he threw it inside a culvert that ran under this dirt road. He just shoved it in there as far as he could get it to go. And then they jumped in the car and took off. And at this point, the realization settles over Derek that because he had to jam that back door open with his backpack to run and get his co-conspirators because they were running late, he never picked it up. It was still there. And it wasn't just any backpack. It had his McDonald's uniform and his McDonald's name tag. It was a neon sign pointing to Derek Wood. He had to explain that. He was afraid to go back and get it because they too had seen the cab driver, so they knew police would be on the way. So he informed Darren and Freeman that he forgot the knapsack. And they came up with this instant plan where he would say he was there smoking and that he heard shots and ran away.
With that, we will end part one of this series covering the 1992 Sydney River McDonald's murders. In part two, which will be released shortly, the story will pick up just as Derek Wood splits up from Freeman McNeil and Darren Muse to deal with the backpack he left propping open the basement door at the scene of the triple murder. I would like to thank Fonz Jessam, a personal inspiration of mine, for appearing in this episode, and would also like to dedicate this episode to the memory of the victims of the McDonald's murders. If you're interested in hearing more content from the Nighttime Podcast, you may be interested in joining the Nighttime Patreon group, where for $1 per month, you'll have access to a monthly bonus episode. You can join by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. That's patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. And with that said, on behalf of myself and the show's listeners, I'd like to thank the continued support of the show's current patron group and welcome the newest members, Amanda, Marius, and Brooke of the Actual Innocence podcast. In addition to providing me great pride and motivation, without you, the production of this show would not be possible. I would like to thank you for listening to the Nighttime Podcast. If you enjoy your time here, please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. And to stay up to date with the show, please follow me at facebook.com/nighttimepodcast and on Twitter, where my handle is @nighttimepod. If you have any story ideas or have some feedback for the show, I'd always enjoy hearing from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.